It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, a new technology out of UW hopes to turn foot traffic into green energy. First, these were familiar sounds in the past 18 months or so here in Wisconsin.
If we stand together and unite, we will win this nomination. And we will win the general election. We will beat Hillary Clinton. And we will turn this country around.
The way we figure it, under Senator Sanders' plan, the state of Wisconsin would have to put in $300 million over 10 years for free college.
In 22 days, we are going to win the state of Wisconsin. And we are going to win back the White House. We are going to win it back. We're going to win this state, folks.
Let me tell Governor Walker, he may have won a short-lived victory here against the unions, but that short-term victory will not stand in the long run.
Moments from visits to Wisconsin by presidential candidates Ted Cruz, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and Bernie Sanders. Our state saw many presidential candidates and their representatives come through during the primary and general election seasons. There's a lot of organization that goes into those appearances and a lot of hidden costs, sometimes to the campaigns, but also to the cities and towns that host them. Turns out those municipalities are often left holding the bag for those expenses. Doug Schneider joins us now. He's been reporting on this. He's a watchdog reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Green Bay. Doug, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, yeah, a lot of people may not think about who pays when a candidate comes. What kind of expenses are often incurred by a local government when there's a high-profile political visit?
Well, a lot of it is related to policing, everything from crowd control, traffic control, to security at the venue, bomb sniffs, escorting the candidate to and from an airport or from venue to venue. That all adds up. And there can also be some public works fees. If it's a public facility like a UW branch, there could be rental costs involved as well.
So no problem if I'm the local government, I'll just send a bill to the campaign, or is it that simple?
Well, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. We found that it's about 50-50 in terms of reimbursements so far for bills that have been issued. And there are also some obstacles. If a sitting president makes a campaign appearance, there are certain Secret Services protections that are required that the local police cannot bill for.
Do we have a lot of cities currently with unpaid bills to presidential campaigns?
We didn't take a statewide look, but across the 10 newspapers in the upper USA Today Wisconsin network, we found that more than a half dozen communities have bills that either they can't collect on or that they've just decided to write off because they've had difficulties in the past or because they view it as community service and part of their duty.
What kind of numbers are we talking about? And give some examples of some of the cities that are on the hook or just, as you say, writing it off.
Well, Green Bay is one that's pursuing most aggressively the trying to recoup what it's laid out. They have about $37,000 in unpaid bills related to policing. The largest individual bill was close to $12,000, but you may find things as small as a couple hundred. Tim Kaine's appearance on November 6th was got $204 of service from the Green Bay Police Department, which I think was one officer.
Talking to Doug Schneider for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Green Bay, looking at the costs of presidential campaign visits, the candidates themselves, or their surrogates to the state. Some cities around Wisconsin hoping to collect still or writing off what they might have been owed for security and other expenses. Now, some of these were planned in advance, some weren't. How big a problem is it for local officials when these are announced a week out or shorter notice than that?
A lot of times there's not that much notice, and we have this thing in Green Bay called the Packers that occasionally brings 80,000 or so people to town. There was an appearance on the day of a Packers game, and I'm drawing a blank on which game it was, but the police said to the campaign, hey, we can spare one officer, and this is a department with probably 180 sworn officers. So we also found that outside the state, on occasion, cities have said no. It's just not enough notice. We don't have the resources. I believe in one case in Oshkosh, the city was contacted about 90 minutes before an appearance, and they basically had to say, you know, hey, sorry, we just can't do it in that short a window.
Apart from the direct financial costs, are police departments saying they're stretched a little extra thin when they're providing security?
Most have told us that they've been able to make it work. We saw at the Donald Trump appearance on October 17th, you'll see supervisors in uniform. Places have pulled detectives or school resource officers out of those assignments or gotten, I guess, with school officers, they got lucky because it was a Good Friday event and there was no school in session and they were able to reassign three officers. On occasion, where it's a really big deal, you'll see things like an animal control officer pressed into road patrol duty or something like that. But most departments say they've been able to make it work. There's also a ton of cooperation between agencies, particularly in smaller communities. The Wausau area departments basically approach these as a team effort. You have appearances in places as small as Rothschild, which has about 5,300 residents, where they know they're not going to be able to do it on their own, and other departments pitch in to help out.
Yeah, I mean, with a Rothschild event, some of these campaign events would have been bigger than the population of the city. So they go into it assuming that they're going to look for help to the outside, and then do all those agencies try to bill a campaign?
Again, it depends on the market. The Wausau PD told us that they basically view it as part of their job, part of their duties, and they have not actively pursued billing. Appleton basically writes off its policing costs. They had about $8,500 in expenses from a visit from Donald Trump and another one from Bernie Sanders. It really depends on the department. Some have had bad experiences in the past where they haven't been able to get any traction or even to get a response. And I think others are saying it's not worth the effort to try and track down. In some cases, a campaign basically goes out of business not long after the campaign season. And in that case, good luck tracking down payment.
And this is a bipartisan issue, isn't it? It isn't just one party or the other racking up these bills.
Absolutely. The only candidate, again, Green Bay had a number of visits from a number of candidates and surrogates. The only candidate that was current on all his appearance-related expenses was Ted Cruz, and he tended to run up very small. He did a lot of smaller venues, meet and greets, screening of a movie, things like that. So we're talking three-figure expenses.
Now, this is getting a little intangible here. Do you get the sense, you've talked to some different people, do local governments feel honored, love the attention they're getting, love the fact that they're in the national media, or is it more headache than that's worth?
I don't know that it's an either or. Certainly in some places it's a challenge for police to all of a sudden have to deal with an extra few thousand people downtown in the middle of the day or at rush hour. But as somebody on one of our comment threads pointed out today, you also have people spending money. You've got perhaps advanced teams staying in hotels. So there is a a payoff there. But I didn't see or hear a lot of people going around bragging that, you know, hey, this event happened in Green Bay. People understand that, you know, candidates do a lot of visits a lot of places, and it's kind of part of the deal.
Are other cities around the country in the same boat trying to collect on debts from presidential campaigns?
Absolutely. Burlington, Vermont considered suing the Trump campaign to collect an $8,500 debt before eventually deciding that it would be more costly to pursue legal action. Tucson, Arizona is said to be looking at a lawsuit relating to about $82,000 in expenses. Small city in California that we spoke with, they actually got to the point where they were requiring small deposits, $2,500 and the like, so they'd at least be guaranteed to have something. And they still, even though there were talks ahead of time, hey, we need to get repaid for this, it took the campaign 10 weeks to pay that bill.
Doug, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Doug Schneider. He's a watchdog reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Green Bay, looking at some of the nitty-gritty of politics, how some Wisconsin municipalities are left with unpaid bills from presidential candidate and their surrogate visits. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, if you're looking to make some changes in your life, you might want to think like a designer. Our guests say you can step-by-step design a better life for yourself. First, we take a look at a new renewable energy source that could literally be right under our feet. A new method developed by UW-Madison engineers could turn your floor tiles into energy converters, and they're doing it using material that often goes to waste. Shudong Wong spoke with Veronica Rickert recently. He's an associate professor in the Materials Science and Engineering Department at UW-Madison and recently published the details about the recent advance in renewable energy.
Tell us how you're planning to make flooring more eco-friendly.
This is our long-term research goal for us to harvest energy from the environment. This is a totally green way for us to generate in recyclable and eco-friendly energy. So harvest energy from the floor or from people walking is one very attractive way for us to produce appreciable amount of energy.
Right, and if you think about the amount of energy that gets used when people, say, go to a football game, they're walking in a stadium, you can see about the potential of energy there. Tell us why you're looking particularly at flooring.
Flooring is a common product that goes everywhere, and it's also a very cost-effective and general construction material that people have to interface every day. So this offers a very good opportunity for us to harvest energy from that perspective.
And when we talk about flooring, you're not looking at every kind of floor. You're looking at a specific mystery ingredient that has a lot of potential. Tell us what that is.
Yes. So this is a concept for us to convert the mechanical force from people stepping on it into electricity. So this is called triboelectric effect. Basically, if we have any two materials, if they have different ability to attract electrons, once they're contacted with each other, electron will go from one to the other. And then if these two materials moved away from each other a little bit, then charge will go back. So they will create current. It's a same phenomenon as we had a static charge on our hand in the wintertime.
And so it sounds like you're looking specifically at the ingredient of wood pulp. Why wood pulp?
We are looking at material that is cheap, cost-effective, eco-friendly, recyclable. So to make this technology becomes very affordable and applicable in the general public. So wood pulp is a material that is an essential component for making a floor, and it's also eco-friendly and recyclable material. And particularly in Wisconsin, there's a lot of forest product. So I think this is a very appropriate material for us to look into that.
Can you tell us more about how these floorboards that you're designing might work? Does a person walking on them, you know, have a different experience? Does it feel any different walking on this energy-generating wood pulp floor?
No, I don't think there's any difference when people walk on it. It's still the same floor as we use every day because we use the same material as a composite that we put together. The only difference that we made is we use some chemical process to treat the wood fiber to change the electrical property of the fiber. Then we put them together, leave a very tiny space between them, so they will have some contact and generate electricity.
And it sounds like the floorboards could actually be layered to generate even greater electrical output. Is that right?
Right. Our current device have just one layer, but definitely we can put multiple layer inside of the floor, so the output will be multiplied.
How does the energy get stored? I understand the concept that you walk on it, it generates an electrical charge, and it's sort of like a static shock going back and forth between the electrons. But how do you capture the electricity?
The capture is pretty straightforward. We can just connect it with a battery or rechargeable battery. So the electrical current will be stored in the battery. And then we can use the energy stored in the battery to whatever purpose that we want to do.
And it sounds like you have some prototypes of these floors available. You've been working on them already. How does it work so far? Are you happy with what you're seeing?
Yeah, our prototype is pretty successful. Right now in our lab, we made one foot by one foot wood panel. And if we step on it, it will generate more than 30 volts output. And can light up more than 30 LED lights at the same time. We are very happy about this result, and we are trying to make it in larger scale.
We're talking right now with Xudong Wang, Associate Professor in the Material Science and Engineering Department at UW-Madison. He's talking about a new source of renewable energy, flooring material made from wood pulp that could convert energy from human footsteps. Now, let's talk about the potential here. Right now, you said you have a 1 foot by 1 foot prototype that you're working on. You're happy with the results. I imagine that's just the beginning. How far could this technology take us? Where would you like to see it used?
I really want to see this technology can be used in our daily life, and could it be a new green building material that put inside the shopping mall, subway station or stadium, harvest the energy from people walking by. This is a significant amount of energy. It will make a substantial contribution to the renewable energy that we are using inside the building.
So let's say you have it in the Lambeau Field Stadium, the Packers Stadium, and you've got this kind of flooring there. Does this have the potential to kind of power the whole stadium? Give me a scope of what kind of electricity we're talking about.
So this type of technology, because it's energy harvesting, so it depends on how much energy is available. For example, how many people is walking or is standing over there. So actually, we did a quick calculation based on our Badger football stadium. So given the capacity of 80,000 people, and if we put one block on each seat and one step from each person, they probably will be able to light up more than 100 the high energy light in the stadium.
Wow. So that sounds like a lot to me. So this is a significant, this could be a significant development in renewable energy sources.
I think so, yes. The reason is this walking energy over there is a significant energy source, and we just need to come up with an appropriate method to reuse it.
And you mentioned that wood pulp itself is cost effective, doesn't cost a lot of money. Are there any other hidden costs here that could surprise us?
The only extra cost that need to be implemented to this technology, one is a chemical treatment. So basically it's a large-scale solution-based chemical treatment. There are standard approaches. So I don't expect that the huge amount of cost will be implemented through this new technology.
Well, a lot of times when we think about renewable energy, what comes to mind is solar power. Do you think that this technology that you're working on could rival that or maybe be less expensive?
I think it's definitely less expensive, but I would say it's more make up the energy output from the solar panels, because in the building inside or in the night, there's no continuous light over there, and this one can kick in. And also, regarding the energy availability, so solar power in the sunny daylight time is definitely more higher than this availability, but it's comparable to the energy availability in the cloudy day, and it's even higher than the room light.
So what happens if you've got in your household, though? What happens at night when everybody goes to sleep and nobody's walking on the floorboards?
Right. I think that's one limitation. If there's no people walking by, then there's no energy. But I think based on this kind of situation, this can be used for the energy generation upon needed. For example, the night light, when people get up and need to walk around, the light turns on. And also, it can be used for sensors, for security reason purpose, that you put on your room, people walking on top of this, and you will know somebody's around.
Well, what has to happen next for us to start seeing this kind of technology in our homes and, you know, maybe at the Badger Stadium, Camp Randall, you were talking about?
Yeah, I'm so looking forward to that. We are trying to acquire more resources to scale up this technology and make it in a large-scale demonstration, hopefully put in on campus somewhere that can test the large-scale stability and output and other properties.
Shudong, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you very much.
That was Shudong Wang, associate professor in the Material Science and Engineering Department at UW-Madison. He talked to Veronica Rickard about a new potential source of renewable energy flooring material that can convert energy from our footsteps. Coming up after the news, two Silicon Valley designers show how we can use design thinking to build a life worth living. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's been a week since Election Day, and schools around Wisconsin are dealing with the aftermath of the results. We'll talk to a reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about how schools and teachers are working with students to engage with the election outcome. First, if you're someone who's been wondering all your life what it is you're actually going to do when you grow up, there's some good news. Our next guests are Silicon Valley innovators who also teach design at Stanford University. They say we never really get done figuring out the answer to that question. They also believe we can apply design thinking to craft a life that is fulfilling, successful, and meaningful. And they say we can do that no matter how old we are or what we've been up to in our lives so far. They join me now. Bill Burnett is executive director of the Stanford Design Program and co-founder of the Life Design Lab, a former leader of Apple's PowerBook product line. And Dave Evans is adjunct lecturer for the product design program at Stanford. He's a management consultant and co-founder of Electronic Arts. They've co-written the new book, Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived and Joyful Life. Bill and Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
I think of design as a way to design, I guess, stuff, a product, a software, something like that. Bill, let's start with you. How can we use design to design our lives?
You know, you're right. A lot of people, when they think of design, they think of like graphic design or interior design, these sort of craft-based professions that are fantastic for building those sorts of things. At Stanford, for a long time now, since back in the 60s, we've been thinking about design more as an innovation methodology. And so we talk about the mindsets of a designer being curious and reframing problems. And we talk about the methods of using, you know, sort of design research and empathy to really unlock, you know, hidden needs and come up with really innovative solutions. So that's what design thinking is differently, I think, from design.
And Dave, as I understand it, you guys teach this class on designing your life. It was originally intended for Stanford students. The problem is every time somebody hears about it, they say, hey, can I do that too?
Yeah, we describe what we do, and the snazzy answer is we apply the innovation principles of design thinking to the wicked problem of designing your life at or after university life. Everybody goes, ooh, that sounds interesting. What does that really mean? And we say, well, we're the guys that teach the courses that help you figure out what you want to be when you grow up. And then everybody goes, oh, can I take the class? And until, you know, this fall, we unfortunately had to say to everybody that wasn't one of the 16,000 matriculated students here at Stanford University, no, unfortunately, you can't. We just got really tired of saying no to people. So Bill and I sat down and said, how can we start saying yes in a different way to lots of people? And the book became the idea for that. So we started writing the book in order to be able to give, it as turns out, everyone who has an interest in the rest of their life, which turns out to be just about everybody, and would like a few more innovative ideas about how to answer that question, some tools that they can use.
When I think about designing a better life, well, I don't think of it in design terms, first of all, but when I think about plotting out a course in life, I think about thinking, and it sounds like introspection and knowing myself. If I'm reading you guys right, thinking and that kind of thing, that's not really the best way to start, is it?
Well, you know, there is a part in the book where very early on where we say, you know, write down what you think the meaning of life is or the purpose of life, and write down what you think the meaning of work is. And we put those two things together. We call them a compass. So there's a place in our method for introspection, but sure, there's a thing in design thinking about a bias to action and trying things. You know, the world is going to be out there in the world. That's where the interesting information is, and you're trying to invent your future, and you can't get information about the future, so you got to sort of sneak up on it and try a lot of little things, we call them prototypes, to have the experience to see if what you're thinking about is actually what you're going to respond to when you try it.
And Dave, you use the phrase wicked problem, and that sounds like just a slang. That's actually a thing for designers. What is a wicked problem?
It is, in fact, a technical term developed way back in the 70s by our friends across the bay at the University of California at Berkeley in urban planning. Turns out, you know, inventing a city is a pretty nasty problem. A wicked problem is the definition of first of all, let me compare it to a tame problem. Its opposite is a tame problem. Tame problems are well-bounded, well-behaved problems that act the same on Tuesday as they do on Monday, and you can solve those problems. And when you build the bridge or you put an astronaut on the moon, you do one of those tame problem solutions, that solution will work over and over again, and every engineer could get the same answer if they use the same equations. Not everything in life is tame. Wicked problems are ones where the definition of success is constantly moving. You don't even know if you got the right answer until you actually find it. And once you find it, you can't use it over again. You can't pick up New York City and drop it on Singapore and expect it to work. You can't pick up, you know, Bill Burnett and drop him on Dave Evans or on Rob Ferret and expect it to work. So the wicked problems are, in fact, human problems. They're messy problems, the answers to which lie in this interesting place we've never been before called the future. And the only way to get to the future is to build your way there. You can't think your way there because we haven't been there yet.
Talking to Bill Burnett and Dave Evans about their new book, Designing Your Life, Solving the Wicked Problem of How to Figure Out What We Want to Do with Our Lives and How to Get There. You guys try to bust some unproductive ways of thinking. And one thing that I think all of us have probably heard at one point or another is the idea that we should find our passion and follow it. Bill, what's wrong with that?
Well, you know, we're here at Stanford, and it's a research university, so you can't just make stuff up. You got to have research. And we went over to the Center for the Study of Adolescence. A good colleague, a friend of ours, Bill Damon, has been studying this question of passion. And it turns out, you know, less than 20, 25% of the people, when they did this kind of surveying, have any one single identifiable passion. Most people, 8 out of 10 people, have lots of things they're interested in or nothing that they could identify that would organize their activity. So we kind of think a method that leaves 8 out of 10 people, you know, at the end of the line waiting to figure out what their passion is doesn't work. And there's a lot of evidence that you actually find your passion by working. You find something that you enjoy doing and you do it more and more, and pretty soon you get really good at it, and pretty soon you discover, hey, this is really what I'm here for. So passion's an end product, not a starting point, and all the research says it's just a bad place to start.
And Dave, another mistake, it sounds like, is to lock in on something. I majored in blank, so I have to do blank. I set my career course years ago. I wanted to be a blank, so all my efforts have to go there. It sounds like we need to break out of that kind of thinking.
You know, we call these ideas dysfunctional beliefs, things that are frankly just not true. They're very popular in the cultural conversation, or they're at least not generative. They're not very life-giving. This idea that I really should do what I studied in college. 75% of college graduates within 5 to 10 years of graduation are working outside their field of undergraduate study. You know, so clearly that's not necessarily determinant for most people. And the average, even large research university offers 60 to 75 different undergraduate majors. There are over 7 billion people in the world. Do the math. There are more than 60 things that people do. So these questions, you have to be very careful about the questions you start with, because all questions believe something. Gee, what'd you major in, Rob? Oh, I majored in anthropology. Gee, what are you going to do with that?
How'd you know?
That's actually what I majored in. Is that true, really?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Have you been doing background research?
Well, we're deeply intuitive. We do that work, too. But those questions all believe something. You know, they believe passion is the starting place. They believe your undergraduate studies should determine your career path. You got to watch out for the sneaky beliefs that hide into your questions, because problem finding is more important sometimes than problem solving. So how you define what problem you're starting with, what questions you ask yourself, is a very important part of design.
Well, Bill, where do we start then? Whether we're just out of high school or college, or maybe we're mid-career or looking to have that post-retirement career, what questions should we be asking ourselves? What should we be evaluating?
You know, we've worked across that spectrum with college students, with people in their mid-careers, with people, you know, looking at the encore career. And really the questions, the process is kind of the same. We describe it in really simply in three steps. Get curious about something. What are you curious about that's going on in the world of work or in the world of commerce? What new things are going on that didn't exist when you got out of college? Then go have some conversations. We call these prototype conversations. Talk to people who are living in the future, doing the thing you might be wanting to do, but you're not sure. Have a conversation with them. Ask them for their story. That's all you got to do. Buy them a cup of coffee and ask their story. And from that, you're going to get some sense of what might be next for you. Then you want to go try stuff, to have a prototype experience. Maybe, hey, being a radio talk host might be interesting. Could I shadow you for a day and see what it's like? So get curious, talk to people, and then try stuff is sort of the whole mantra of the book. It's very action-oriented.
Dave, I feel like I'd be kind of shy about going to someone in a profession that I'm an outsider to and asking them to do it. You've talked to people who have done exactly this, though. What kind of results do they get?
Yeah, first of all, what they get is if they ask the question correctly, and I'll clarify that in just a second, the results they get anecdotally, meaning the feedback we get from our students and our clients, but that's thousands and thousands of anecdotes, is about 7 out of 10 times it works, meaning 7 out of 10 times you ask for a conversation or a cup of coffee, you actually get it and typically have a pretty interesting conversation. Now, what do you have to do to make that work? You have to ask somebody not for something that's hard to give, like money or leverage to get a job or an appointment to be interviewed. You ask for a conversation to just tell me my story. Gee, I've done the research. It turns out, Rob, you are one of the most interesting guys in the entire North Midwestern states.
I'd love
to get together. You and I share the common interest that you and I both think what you do for a living is really interesting. So maybe you could tell me that story. So when you ask for that conversation, maybe not quite that way, but that's the idea, most people like to tell their story. They find what they're doing in their lives pretty interesting. So you share that ground. The hard part then, of course, becomes how do I get that conversation? That takes us back to networking. I've got to have talk to people. But if I'm talking to people in order to get something as simple as, would you mind letting me have access to someone you know of for whom I could buy a cup of coffee and allow them to have a great time talking about their favorite subject, that's not nearly as scary as other kinds of requests. And in a world with the internet and LinkedIn and so on, everyone who is out there on LinkedIn, you know, which is just about everybody now, is in a sense saying through the internet, sure, you can call me, I'm open for business. So this has never been an easier time to do this kind of thing.
We're using design principles to build a meaningful life and career. Our guests are Bill Burnett and Dave Evans, both designers. They lecture at Stanford. They're co-authors of the new book, Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived and Joyful Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done this? Are you doing something like this? Are you at a crossroads, maybe fresh out of school, maybe mid-career, maybe looking for a thing to do after retirement? What are you weighing? What are you looking at? Do you need some advice from our guests on how to start making decisions, starting to build that future? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about applying design principles to help us create a meaningful life, meaningful career. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What questions do you have for our guests about designing a richer, more satisfying life for yourself? What are you evaluating right now in your life? How are you making decisions? Talking with Bill Burnett and Dave Evans. Their new book is Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived and Joyful Life. Before we go to our callers, Bill, tell me about a good time journal. This is one of the exercises in your book. What is that? How do we do it?
Yeah, you know, a lot of times people don't even take the time to sort of notice what's working in their lives. And we think that if you pay attention to sort of where the energies go in your day, you know, what makes you feel more energetic, what makes you feel less, particularly if you can track things that the psychologists call flow states, states where you're kind of in the zone and working at your best, and also things that, you know, that that you're grateful for. You just take the day, a little moment at the end of every day. It's a very light journaling sort of experience. Write down a couple of experiences, rate the energy and the flow states, and just to make you sort of get aware of how you're actually, you know, showing up in the world. So when somebody says, hey, how's it going? You actually have some data about how's it going.
And Dave, people are surprised by what they find when they do this.
Yeah, you know, most of us are so busy living our lives, we don't have time to pay attention to them. You know, so when you ask the question, so what is it you really do love about being, you know, a radio personality, Rob, or involved in this? Or, hey, guys, what do you like about teaching? And people are kind of, well, you know, I like it. You know, we don't take time to sit down and really break it down. And so what we're giving people a chance to do is, again, the first step of design is empathy. Really understand the situation before you try to solve it. And in life design, the two things we're trying to empathize with are ourselves, who are we? And what's going on in the world. That's why we, you know, listen to our own story. That's the Good Time Journal, is actually paying attention to your own story. And the conversations we mentioned a minute ago is like paying attention to other people's stories. That information is really, really powerful.
Let's bring on our callers now. We've got Nate starting us off in Ashland. Nate, hi.
Hey.
What do you want to ask about, Nate?
Yeah, so I just graduated with a degree in environmental geoscience, and I was, I'm just kind of at a crossroads as to how quickly I should, you know, jump on my career path, but are like, if my degree will kind of start to lose its credibility the longer I wait.
Okay, guys, go for it. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, first of all, congratulations for graduating. That's, it sounds like a very interesting degree. Hopefully it's something you are interested in maybe spending some time practicing. One, don't worry. The degree doesn't have an expiration date. It'll be fine. The world is not organized. Just, even though you think the world's organized around graduation dates, it isn't really. People get hired in your field, you know, every day and every month of the year. So the question, I guess, is, you know, you want to start a job when you're fully charged up and ready to go. I would do a bunch of these prototype interviews first, talk to people in the field or people, you know, related to environmental issues and other things. See, because there's lots of different versions of that thing in the world, and see which of those makes sense to you. And when you find an opportunity that looks like it's a good fit, that's when it's time, you know. And look, you're going to be working for the, you know, your generation might live to be 100, and you might be working for another 70 years. So
I'm going to have five careers.
Yeah, you know,
Nate,
take your time.
Nate, your question was, how soon should I jump on my career? And what if we reframe the question to, well, how soon would you like to jump on your life? You know, your career is not going to expire. Career is a word we use to describe our professional endeavors. And, you know, the career isn't a train that's going to leave without you. It sounds like maybe there might be other things you want to do than jump right into the, you know, the geo world or the environmental world. But you started thinking about, well, how would I like to live? How would I like to spend my time? Now, if that involves doing absolutely nothing related to this field for 20 years, well, then there might be an expiration problem. I didn't quite get around to being an energy advanced technologist myself. And 40 years later, that's going to be a little hard to renew. But, you know, there's not really a deadline.
Nate, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234, and good luck to you. We'll go next to Cameron in La Crosse. Cameron, hi.
Hi. I just am so glad to hear that design thinking is getting a little airtime. I am a graduate student at the University of Minnesota and a nurse, and we are currently trying to incorporate some of these design principles into healthcare and the processes we see in healthcare. And it feels like our society has totally taken creativity, out of the mix and made it so rigid for individuals that trying to get these principles into healthcare have been extremely difficult from those in senior management and senior leadership. So I was just curious if you had any, I guess, recommendations on how we kind of break the mold and start thinking again. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks, Cameron. Dave, how to spread the design love to other areas of our lives and workplaces?
Well, I'm very sympathetic with executives who are running organizations and are a little worried that we're going to run off and have all these wild ideas and hey, we got a business to run here. So I'm sympathetic with the places that act the way that the caller said might be being a little bit stiff. You know, but you know, Bill ran a design consultancy for quite a few years and has answered this question lots of times.
You know, the other thing is healthcare is a huge issue. In fact, so big that we just have restarted our master's program around two themes that we think are the most important thing for designers to work on, and healthcare is one of them. So I would encourage the caller to check in with the D School. We have lots of online stuff. We're doing a lot of work in the healthcare space. It's sorely in need of some innovation. I mean, there's amazing people out there, nurses and others, who are doing good work, but to do it in a more effective way, a more creative way, a more human-centered way is always going to be better. So check out the D School website and, you know, contact us, and we have a lot of support in the area, particularly around design thinking in healthcare, because it's so important.
Cameron, thanks for the call. We're talking to Bill Burnett and Dave Evans, authors of Designing Your Life. And we'll go back to our callers. Regina in Denmark. Hi.
Hi, this is Regina.
Hi.
Bill and Dave, I want to thank you for the conversation around designing your life. I work with a lot of individuals who are mid-career and are essentially doing a renovation. I'll use that description. Trying to really figure out where they want to go next, but they're so tied into these beliefs about themselves and assumptions that they've made throughout the year that it's hard to get them to break, to think about a new paradigm, a new way of approaching their life. Any suggestions for how somebody can start that process?
Regina, thanks. Bill, where can she start helping those people break those assumptions?
Well, you know, we just got a wonderful comment from someone who had read the book that said one of the biggest things in the book was this idea of reframes, that I'm not stuck. I can reframe these problems and find new solutions. And one of the things we talk about is don't plan, you know, when you're trying to think of what's next, don't think of one thing. Think of three. Brainstorm a lot. Designers know that you got to brainstorm a lot of ideas before you get to the ones that are actionable. And so I think we see this a lot in the workshops we do around the country. Mid-career folks feel stuck. You know, probably even when they've been pretty successful at what they're doing, but they want to do something else. And now they haven't built a lot of muscle around their creativity and imagining alternatives. But I would encourage you to work with the folks you're working with and have them do, we always have them do three. What we call odyssey plans or ideations, three completely different plans before they even, you know, start thinking about what they might want to implement.
Interesting, Regina. Hope that helps. Rachel joins us now in Milwaukee. Rachel, briefly, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the air.
What do you want to ask?
Yeah, I do want to ask a question. So what advice do you have for the people who are in a position where they really, you know, feel like they enjoy work and things like that, but after a time, it just sort of becomes, you know, a routine, and not saying, you know, you're kind of stuck in a rut, but you're really just, like, looking for ways to revive that excitement about work.
Rachel, thanks. Just a bit of time left. Dave, advice on maybe getting out of that little rut there.
Yeah, you know, in his first book, Martin Seligman, the positive psychologist, said it's not about finding the job perfect or what we sometimes call the job charming. It's about finding the job you can make more perfect, you can perfect. So if you go through the ideation process Bill just mentioned, actually do some odyssey planning, have one, two, three ideas. Very often we find people don't leave their current reality, but they end up taking ideas they had from a completely different domain and finding ways to either reframe or export those back into my current situation. So one of the best ways to make where I am more interesting is think about what I would do if I weren't here. And then say, wait, what does that inform me that I actually can convert back into this situation? That's a way to refresh the whole situation.
Rachel, thanks. Hope that helps. And that's a good place to leave it. Bill, Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We've been talking to Dave Evans, adjunct lecturer for the product design program at Stanford University, and Bill Burnett, executive director of the Stanford Design Program. We've been talking about their new book. It's called Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived and Joyful Life. Still time for you to share your stories. If you've been through a process like this, head over to the Central Time Facebook page. How did you decide what the next step was? What did you weigh? What kind of pros and cons, whether that's, again, out of school, late in life, or somewhere in between? Head over, share your story right now on the Central Time Facebook page. Born on this day in 1887 on a dairy farm near Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, legendary artist Georgia O'Keeffe, known for her landscapes, her cityscapes, and her flowers. We've got an article about Georgia O'Keeffe up at WPR.org. There's a link on the Central Time Facebook page. She knew at age 12, apparently, that she was going to be an artist. Some people do find that passion right away. Most of us don't, it sounds like, as we just heard. She did. She knew at age 12 she was going to be an artist. She found inspiration in part from Wisconsin's nature and from local art teachers in the area. She ended up going on to the Art Institute of Chicago. She did a lot of her creative work in New York and across the country in New Mexico, where a lot of her most famous work came from. She never ended up living here in Wisconsin again, but she did keep her connection with the state, still had a lot of family here. There are a lot of things named after her in Wisconsin now, and she was awarded an honorary degree by the University of Wisconsin in 1942, and she got the Wisconsin Governor's Award for Creativity in the Arts in 1966. So today we mark Georgia O'Keeffe's birth anniversary here on Central Time.